The Term Machine Radio.
Hi guys, welcome to episode 3 of Hot Dub Time Machine Radio. My name's Tom, aka Hot Dub Time Machine. Welcome, it's lovely to have you here. On this podcast, I chat to musicians that I love about their life and music. But before we get into that, I just want to give you guys a quick update on what's happening. We just had the first Hot Dub Wine Machine for 2018 in Swan Valley, Western Australia, and it went really, really great. I'm super proud of it. We had 15,000 people sold out in Oakover Grounds, which is a beautiful vineyard all around a lake, and the day was sunny and everything went great. I particularly want to mention like a couple of the music highlights that you guys might want to check out. Kite Street Tangle has developed into one of the best festival acts I've seen. He tours with the drummer and he sings and does it all live. It's really worth checking out. And Connie from Sneaky Sound System can really, really sing. Now, I guess like most people know that she's a great singer and she's, you know, coach you on the voice and that kind of stuff, but to see her in front of a crowd that big sing the way she does, it's really something to see. And I'm hoping to chat to her and Angus next week and to record a bit of an interview for you guys to hear. But for this week, I'm interviewing Tom Tilley. Now, Tom's mainly known in Australia as the host of Hack, which is youth station Triple J's current affairs show. He's the calm voice of reason in many heated debates and has interviewed everyone from the Prime Minister to rock stars. But he also has this interesting double life as a bass player in the ARIA award-winning live act Client Liaison, who are incredible. And he DJs all over town, including at Hot Dub Wine Machine. I interviewed Tom at his house back in November 2017, which is a while ago, and he was just beginning his long recovery from a pretty horrific motocross accident. I was a bit nervous to be interviewing an interviewer of Tom's stature. See if you can spot how anxious I am in my first question. Here we go. I'm here with Tom Tilley. Tom is wearing a lovely purple plaster cast on his foot. How are you going, mate?
Oh, it's been a weird week, dude. Grappling with a few injuries. I'm wearing a couple of casts and got some interesting news this week that I'll need a full knee reconstruction as well. Like there's fractures, screwed ligaments, a completely ruptured ACL.
And so, and this happened through riding a motorbike.
Yeah. I was riding a dirt bike out in Mudgee, which is my hometown where I grew up in. And that was a sport that I loved. Like one of my big loves as a kid was riding dirt bikes. And I thought I could just jump straight back on and give it a crack and jump on a motocross racetrack and start cruising around. And I was feeling good, hitting some jumps. And then what they call in the lingo of motocross, I whiskey throttled it.
What does that mean?
It means that you hit some really high revs just as you're leaving the ground. So the back wheel sort of has like a turbo charge of power just as you leave the ground.
Oh, okay. So it kind of spins out from under you.
So the bike kind of flips in the air.
Right.
And from several meters up, I came down in that position with the bike vertical sort of on top of me and landed. And I thought I'd ripped the hamstring off the bone on one side and I knew I'd broken a thumb, but I had no idea that I'd done like a really fucked up knee injury and broken my foot.
Did you have time while you were up in the air to have a thought about what was going to happen?
I knew I was hitting the deck, yeah. I wasn't thinking, oh, my life's ending. It's like, oh, I'm going to have a crash.
Yeah.
It's not that big a deal to crash a motorbike usually.
Okay, yeah, man, I just want to learn a little bit more about you and where you come from. So you grew up in Mudgee.
Yeah.
Did you have much music around the house? Do your parents play any music?
Yeah, my dad played the violin. He kind of ripped into like barnyard dancing and kind of country music.
And so would you hear that around the house?
Yeah, I'd hear that around the house for sure.
Anything particular? I remember my mum and dad used to play the Bushwhackers quite a bit.
Oh, man.
That might be.
Oh, he'd love to rip into a bit of Patchabelle's Canon. Like the wedding tune.
On the violin, yeah. Just like bust it out.
Okay. I was also a Christian growing up as well, so there's a lot of music in the house for that reason.
Were there records playing of
Christian No, it was more like we were singing a lot. Like I grew up a strong singer. Like
okay.
I loved to sing. We sang all the time, so we're singing a lot at church.
And so then you were in the church choir as kind of a...
Not so much choir, it was more like a born-again Pentecostal sort of thing. So
right.
Like singing at church. I was performing pretty early on, like in church. That's where I kind of did my first like shows.
Far out.
Yeah.
I heard a bit about that on Tom Ballard's thing about the cult, as you described them. Not my word.
Yeah.
Did you learn music on any instruments or anything? Or you?
Yeah. So, we're getting into a bit of music at church. And then, you know, my parents were bringing like most families in the 80s were listening to Paul Simon's Graceland, white cassette tape that a lot of people probably remember fondly that was in their parents' car.
My dad was a 60s guy.
Oh, really?
That's all I grew up with.
And my dad was massively into Mark Knopfler as well. His album, his solo album, Local Hero, was
right.
One of my dad's favourite pieces.
What's a song off that?
It has that big melody that it's all instrumental pretty much. It's okay. Da 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 da. It's a really beautiful piece.
And did you like that as a kid? Did you go, that song's awesome?
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I would have rather been listening to the latest pop music, but it was still pretty cool.
Was there any Triple J in the house?
There was eventually, but my dad wasn't into it. He thought it was washing machine music was his description, but some of his labourers, he had a fencing business and we built a house and some of the labourers were pretty adamant about putting Triple J on. So
right.
I distinctly remember hearing that song as a teenager. I want to be a hippie and I want to get stoned on marijuana.
Yeah.
I really remember the novelty songs from Triple J.
Well, I assume we're talking the 90s.
Yeah.
And it was actually an amazing time for the kooky songs.
Yeah.
Like,
the Fives were kind of happening.
I my favorite is Dave Graney and the Coral Snakes, Rock and Roll's Where I Hide. Do you remember that?
Yeah. Oh, I should tell
you. And Nick Cave, like Red Right Hand, there was just like so much kooky music.
There's a lot of fun in music then.
Mm.
And a lot of taking the piss.
Yes, absolutely.
With a touch of anger, maybe even.
Maybe that came about as a... because rebelling against the 80s excess and all that kind of stuff, the glamour rock was time to not take it quite so seriously.
Or maybe grunge had been too serious and this was a reaction to that.
Did you do well at school? Did you go to school out in Mudgee did you go somewhere else? Okay.
No, I went right through to year 12. Like a lot of my friends came down to boarding schools in Sydney, but I stayed in Mudgee kicking out jams at Mudgee High.
Were you learning piano or anything like that?
Yep, started learning, got piano lessons once we were getting into music. So... just learned some basics, never really kicked off with the piano, but, you know, got across reading a little bit of music and understanding a little about chords and time. And then that sort of stagnated and there was a bit of guitar around. My dad had taught me a few things on violin and a few things on guitar. But then at music class at school, I was thinking that I would be a singer. So we had this elective called Rock Group.
That sounds awesome.
It was so much fun. So I was seeing myself as a singer, and our performance piece was Runaway Train. Runaway train, never coming back. Yep. Bit of a tune. Anyway, we were sitting there and my mate who could play guitar taught me to play Come As You Are on guitar. Just that riff.
So good, isn't it?
Yeah.
So many of those riffs that Nirvana had that just instantly capture a vibe of this kind of...
that was so easy to play, and that was the main thing. So I was like, oh my God, I can play a Nirvana song. And then Frog Stomp had just come out. And so then they taught me to play something tricky, a Suicidal Dream, which has that really nice, really nice...
Who does Suicidal Dream?
That's on Frog Stomp towards the end of the album. Suicidal Dream. Really good song. Probably one of the most underrated songs on that album, I reckon. And
right.
And it's like, oh, wow, I can sort of play these tunes that everyone's into. And it really encouraged me. And then I went back home and we had this family friend in his 20s living at our place. And he was mad for the Beatles. So then I started learning some of the Beatles chords.
And then, so did you have an acoustic?
Playing nylon string acoustic, you know, like most people learn. And so, yeah, suddenly I was able to play like Nirvana and Silverchair and the Beatles. And then my brother was already getting guitar lessons from this really cool local teacher who was really into the blues called Bob Burns. And so then I started getting guitar lessons as well.
Sweet.
And started to learn, you know, pentatonic blues scales and stuff like that and improve my chords and got kind of into the blues.
And so the piano was left behind. You were into
left the
guitar
piano behind,
now.
Yeah, yeah. Into okay. guitar. I quickly moved away from like being into the contemporary grunge stuff of the day and was like much more drawn to like the Beatles and then moving into 70s stuff. Like Silverchair did a cover at the time of Whole Lotta Love by Led Zeppelin.
Yeah.
And they did a really cool cover of it and that was my introduction to them.
It's kind of, I think it's a common misconception that like people who are teenage or you know, around that age are not into old music. Like, I think you really, it's like when you're 16, 17, 18, you really do go back and it's a time where people rediscover the Beatles and all that kind of thing.
Well, I think, so say you're growing up in the 90s like you and I did, and grunge was a massive thing. Grunge was referencing a lot of 70s stuff, and you could argue that the synth pop revolution of the 2000s was referencing a lot of 80s stuff. So you're borrowing on things that are two or three cycles behind in the current trends. So sure. I think digging the 70s was a pretty natural thing to do in the 90s.
No, I can definitely see that. Did you ever have dreams of making music like a career when you were just jamming in those bands and stuff?
I did.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I remember seeing Daniel Johns just shoot up and I was just like, wow, that could be me.
Did you have any, like you had the rock band thing at school, did any, do you know anyone that kind of did go on to be a musician from there or?
I got a friend who's got a, works with a girl called Aviva, who's like a Sydney singer-songwriter, and they've signed some deal in the US or something. So they're, I think they're doing something, but no, no one else took their music that far.
But in general, yeah, I guess that's not really what Mudgee's known for. How'd you go at school?
I'm good. I was... What were you
best at?
I was best at being an all-rounder. Probably rugby was my best thing. Like,
right.
I was a big rugby player, like, mad for it. Played number seven on the side of the scrum and was pretty aggressive. And
You're right in the thick of it.
Yeah, I loved it.
With the boys, with the culture.
Yeah. I mean, I was a Christian, so I wasn't getting into the boozing and that kind of stuff.
Right.
But, I was also, like, performing big roles in the town musical. I was doing...
What kind of musicals
debating.
Did you do?
One time we did Rodger and Hammerstein's Carousel. It's got that beautiful rousing number at the end, Walk On Through the Storm.
Did you have a what kind of role did you
I
do?
I had a fairly minor part in that one. Like, I was in the chorus and then had a supporting role. But there were some other musicals where I had, like, lead roles, where I was doing the triple threat.
Oh, man, I did some musicals, like school musicals when I was that age. The thing the best was the social scene. I loved it. You'd be with, like, the girls' school up the road.
Yeah.
And it was in hanging out. Did you have that experience with it at all?
Oh, it's awesome. It was a whole different world to hanging out with the rugby boys or the guys I hang out with in the playground. And I think it is a place where you relate to girls differently when you're performing together and engaging in a piece of work and also transcending your normal personality as you lean into these characters that you're trying to portray. So it definitely takes you into a great space. So that's what I loved about growing up. Well, just growing up full stop. But I think growing up in the country, I was able to just try and do everything.
Yeah, that's pretty all round.
Yeah.
Rugby, musicals.
Yeah. And, like, you know, I was a decent swimmer. We came down to, you know, state level.
Were you like school captain and stuff?
Yeah, I was school captain. I was one of those people.
Well, you got the all-around, mate. Were you, like, ticking off the things you needed to be a school captain? Were you ambitious to get that job?
It just happened.
Just happened. Right.
Yeah, I wasn't, like, on the SRC or anything like that.
Okay.
I wasn't too nerdy.
All right, sweet.
Bit of a nerd, not too much.
Did you, obviously, writing is a huge part of your life now. Did you have any passion for it at that age?
I actually thought I was going to be a journalist when I was at high school.
Great.
And, then I got my dad.
Do you remember where that impulse came from? Or
I really liked radio, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And my first work experience was at Bathurst radio station.
This is like year 10 work experience?
B-Rock, 2BS, really? Bathurst. And I hated it. You had to use too many computers. And I was a bit computer illiterate at that stage of life. And so I actually got scared of the studio and got more into the copywriting with the ad team, which is kind of fun. Then I did some newspaper work experience. And then my dad scared me that I'd run out of... I would never make any money being a journalist, so I did a commerce degree at Macquarie.
Yeah.
And that's when I became a nerd.
And that's when you moved to Sydney for the first time? Because Macquarie University is in Sydney.
Yeah, so I...
From the country to the city.
I moved to Pittwater and lived with some family friends.
So Pittwater's kind of up, it's like another Sydney harbour an hour north of Sydney. It's still in the suburbs, but it's very beautiful and isolated. So you were still removed from the...
I think I only crossed the harbour bridge three times that year.
So did you finish your commerce degree?
Yeah, I finished my commerce degree. And actually that's where I became a nerd, was at uni, because I was scared of failing. So
you worked really hard at uni.
I ended up with like a whopping GPA and got a job at Deutsche Bank. And I got offers to Macquarie Bank and a few other places as well. So economics kind of fitted with my brain quite well. Just it's quite an abstract way of modeling the real world. And I didn't find it that hard at all to understand those models they were teaching us at uni, even though initially it scared the shit out of me and I thought I was going to fail. That's why I turned into such a nerd, because I thought I was going to be having to flunk out of uni and go back to Mudgee or something.
And you were still a believer at this point in the
family
religion? I was,
yeah, yeah. I was.
So you didn't discover university partying at that point?
No. Yeah. My partying came...
So with the Euro trip, the legendary Tom Tilly, is that so? You finished uni, you got commerce degree, and then you what did you do then?
Yeah, I won this competition and won a couple of $1,000 for a copywriting competition, and I was like, well, before I
like
start
with an ad campaign,
Well, Clemenger came to our uni and said, here, if you write, you know, the best essay on this question can win $2,000, and I threw in a really left field answer. It actually shows how. The Times, the question was, what are the strategic marketing implications of e-commerce?
Ooh.
And I said that it had no strategic implications, but it had lots of tactical implications.
Ooh.
So sort of did the classic advertising thing where you're like, what? Ah.
Using language to
flip people's perceptions. Yeah.
Indeed.
But so I got a few $1,000 and I was like, well, I've got to start this really serious job soon at Deutsche Bank.
So you hadn't even started the bank job?
I'd started part-time in my last semester.
Okay.
And so I had 6 weeks between part-time and then going full-time. I was like, oh, I've got some money. I might go around the world.
Cool. And so you got the money and then you were off.
It was just six weeks. So I went to, I think it's like 10 days California, a couple of days in New York, then a month in Europe. And never been so scared and lonely my whole life as getting off that plane in LA.
Was that the first time you'd been outside of Australia?
Yep.
Were you traveling with a Discman and a wallet of CDs?
Yeah.
Do you remember what was in the wallet?
I remember the first thing I bought when I got to America. I was walking along the streets of Venice and I saw these two guys sitting outside a cafe playing dominoes and they had a ghetto blaster and I heard something very funky and I just had this, the year before I had my sort of road to Damascus moment in music because I'd grown up, as I said before, liking 60s and 70s kind of stuff, very much from a guitar perspective. And then at Macquarie Uni, they have this annual day, a music festival day called Conception Day. And I was a nerd and I was studying at the library and I didn't drink. So I didn't understand why they were doing like three-legged races and then sculling beers at the end. The beer Olympics didn't really make sense to me. It looked absolutely disgusting. So I went to the library and studied and I came out as the sun was going down and everyone had moved away from, you know, playing beer pong or whatever. And a lot of people had got down in front of the stage and there was something going on down there. And this band was playing something I'd never heard before. It was a perfect fusion of house and funk music live, and it blew my mind. It was Professor Groove and the Booty Affair.
Hey! Well, they were like Sydney funk legends, is that correct?
Yeah. So they were the guys from the band Swoop, who had that big hit Apple Eyes in the mid-90s.
Okay. Well, it's the acid jazz movement was in full effect.
It was sort of like mid to post acid jazz, where people had, you know, re-embraced really, really strong bass lines and saxophones.
Did you ever see Dig?
Oh, yeah. And now I'm friends with some of those guys.
Terrapi Richmond, the Terrapi. Drummer. It's just,
I love playing with him.
Play with Terrapi. We used to go and just watch with my little drumming nerds and just watch him, like just the way he would just sometimes just use one drumstick and just like just tune the snare drum with the other one as he's just laying down a single stick groove.
And he often puts his wallet on the snare to deaden it a little as well. Yeah. He, I think Terrapi Richmond's the coolest person in the world.
Right.
He had to choose between being a pro surfer and a pro drummer. That's how cool he is.
I believe it. So you're at Macquarie Uni, you discovered progressive groove and the Booty Affair and funk music.
And then it had to be four to the floor and it had to be backbeats on the hi-hats.
And so
guitars had to be, it totally changed my thinking about guitars. I never wanted to hear a guitar strum again. Guitars do three things: stabs, palm muting, and solos. That's it.
Is that... As a non-guitar person, is that like funk chops, like dink, 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 kind of thing?
And then the palm like that kind of stuff.
Were you into bass at all?
At that point, not so much. Okay. The moment I turned to bass was a few years later. So I got into playing kind of funky guitar after that. And I you know, it's a James Brown song.
Like playing it just by yourself, like in kind of...
No, my brother had moved down to Sydney and we had a band room set up. We moved to Manly by that point and we live with a bunch of musos. So we were up on North Head in the bush.
And so this is like for last year uni.
Yeah, last year uni. Sick. Yeah, so if you're not from Sydney, there's this like place called Manly on the north of the harbour and you go up and there's a big national park on the headland and it's an old army base. And we were one of the first civilians to ever rent one of these army houses in the bush. So we only had one set of neighbours living with massive harbour views and we could jam till 4 a.m.
Far out.
And my brother was a really energetic and talented but poorly disciplined drummer. So we were jamming all the time and we always had. We jammed since we were like teenagers and we kept going into Sydney.
So yeah, you're in LA. You've gotten off the plane. There's a guy playing a music that you were trying to identify.
Yeah. So I'd gotten into funk music and I heard something pretty funky coming out of the Ghetto Blaster. And I stopped and I was just traveling. So I was like, oh, I'm just going to talk to people. Let's see what happens. I was traveling on my own. Like, guys, what's that? What's that music? And they're like, it's Rick James. What are you talking about? You don't know Rick James?
Which song was it? So like,
I think it was Bustin' Out. We're busting out on the funk. And I was just like, oh my God. And we started talking and I guess I was feeling pretty loose and free at the time. I just started doing this little dance to it. And the guy goes to me, what you go at? The boxing kangaroo? What you doing there? And so they started talking about Rick James. And so then I went to this massive CD store up in San Fran a couple of days later.
Amoeba?
It's in the Haight-Ashbury.
Yeah.
Huge one.
The legendary.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, it's called Amoeba Records. There's one in San Francisco, one in LA. It is a ground zero for music lovers. Still there. Still selling CDs and vinyl.
Yeah, so I bought that and then called the Greyhound down to Mexico and listened to Rick James's greatest hits over and over again. And it was a soundtrack to my life changing.
And so you went from LA down to Mexico. Were you planning to go to Mexico?
Sure what I was doing, but I got over the border and I met these guys at a taco stand and they said, you're not going to like it here. Get me back in no time. They were from San Diego. And I got down there and I felt really uncomfortable. There were like dogs chasing me in the street. I was like an hour past Tijuana.
Well, you'd never been outside of Australia.
Yeah. I was a loser. Yeah. I had no idea what I was doing.
But obviously you were comfortable and confident in your own company and thinking that you could just do it, or you're just kind of stumbling along.
I was scared and lonely, but I was giving it a crack.
I always think when I see young people going off for that tour, that big overseas first thing, you go, you're going to have the best time of your life and the worst time of your life.
Mm.
And they could happen like right next to each other.
Mm.
Is that your experience of it as well?
Absolutely. The lows had never been lower. I never felt more scared and lonely. And the high points were so exhilarating, unbelievably liberating.
Give us a high point. So obviously the legend is the story that I've heard before is that you went over there and discovered a zest and a...
Yeah.
How do you describe what happened to you on your trip?
Well, one of the high points was meeting these Spanish squatters living in London. And I ended up in a taxi ride in a plane with this Spanish woman. She was about 30 and her friends from Madrid all lived in London and they lived in a squat near Brixton and were into raving and, you know, really going for it in that kind of London scene. And they were driving home to Christmas and I'm flying into London with this woman. We happened to be on the same flight from New York and she's like, if you want to jump in the van with us rather than fly to Madrid, come with us. It'll be way more fun. You can help us like share the costs. And, you know, we'll drive through France and, you know, go to Madrid. I was like, done. So I got into London, spent a few days with some of my friends, and then I got in this van and these guys were nuts. Like they were just smoking hashish the whole way.
Were they ravers?
Massive ravers.
So had you heard much dance music before?
No.
Do you remember any of the music that they were playing to?
They were nuts for Basement Jack's Where's Your Head At?
Right.
So imagine us, me and five Spanish ravers, driving through through Dover, over the ferry, into Calais. And anytime that song came on, they would just fucking go nuts. Where's your head at?
Did you find it hard at all to reach out to people when you were on your own traveling?
Nah, it's scary, but you just do it. And you very quickly see where it can get you. It's one of the most exciting things ever to travel on your own and see what happens when you start talking to people. It could go any direction. The things that can happen out on the roads, especially in Europe, like...
Did you go to any raves? Did you develop any love for that scene while you were over there? How did you feel about electronic music at that
time? No, I was into funk by then. That's what I was up for. You know, I had Rick James in the headphones, and I always loved my kind of classic 70s and 80s pop. So that's what I would sort of lean towards at a party. Yeah, I hit some clubs in Barcelona. Probably the first time I'd really been to any decent nightclubs. Like, I've been to a couple in Australia, like Berry Street Tavern and Greenwood during uni.
Well, I used to bartend at Blueberries.
Oh, nice.
That was...
North Sydney used to crank.
Absolutely. Gee, on a Thursday night.
Yeah.
It was mental. I remember I was bartending and I thought I was the man. I pretty much thought that I was like Tom Cruise in Cocktail, the movie, making my strawberry daiquiris at Blueberries on a Thursday night. And then DJ, I would go up to him. I think I just remember Baby One More Time by Britney Spears. Still, it's so good. And I'd ask him to play that and Insomnia by Faithless. Anyway, let's take you post-trip. You come home. Mm. What do you do then?
I put a bomb under my life and broke up with my girlfriend of 3 years and pretty much left the church. I had this epiphany in Barcelona. So I traveled with those Spanish guys and then I went to Barcelona and I partied for 4 days. More than I ever had before. And I used to love to dance and I loved partying. It was always right there for me. Like, even when I was a Christian, it came very naturally. Even when I was sober, I loved that space, that playful space of partying and the way people loosen up and the music and the madness, the mayhem.
It's lovely, the freedom of the way that people are so ready to converse and communicate and stuff.
It's heaven. I came back from Europe and I just wanted to be in Europe. I didn't want to be here. I didn't want to be working at Deutsche Bank. I didn't want to be dealing with having to leave Christianity.
It was only 6 weeks. That's not a long trip, really.
I know. It was crazy. It felt like a long trip.
Mm.
And so I started pulling my life apart and I was really lost and it was really hard and it was like the toughest time in my life. It was pretty tough emotionally for me, and I was like in a big argument with my family about the church and a big argument with the leaders. And
did you come straight home and live with your family back in...
No, they were living in the country in Mudgee. I was down in Sydney with my bro.
Okay, so you were back with the brother. But that's a big thing when you do the overseas trip. The coming home is often the more, even more of an epiphany, but it's just a harder thing to do.
Yeah, totally. The big ideas you come back with, you know, about freedom, about like kind of the idea of sort of global mobility. I'd also had a burst of like wanting to be really compassionate and fix the world as well.
Right.
Which I hadn't had before, despite being a Christian. It was actually traveling that made me feel this sense of like, I guess, think about people less fortunate than us.
Right.
And wanting to be involved somehow. And noticing that there were so many pious Christians who would have said that they were all about helping people, but actually they were just about making themselves look more holy and not about improving the lives of people around them at all.
Right.
They just wanted to get to heaven.
Did you meet some people while you were on your trip that like kind of, or was it just a...
Yeah. And there was a guy that went to that exact point, this nutbag 40-year-old Scottish guy who did a nude streak through Plaza Real in Barcelona. He told me that he was a Christian, but a very liberal one, obviously.
And how'd you meet him? He was staying at a backpacker?
Staying in the same backpackers. Mm. And he was talking about Jesus and how much he loved Jesus. But he was just talking about the stories where Jesus embraced people from more unfortunate backgrounds or prostitutes or different people that meant that he was actually mixing it with all levels of society and not just hanging around with pious people, that he was engaging with the world in a true and an honest sense and painted a much more exciting, compassionate, well-rounded version of what Jesus was supposed to be about. Whereas the slant on it in our church had been more about what you needed to do to be saved and what was righteous and what was not righteous. But this guy, John from Edinburgh, just painted a much more adventurous, exciting, truly compassionate version of who Jesus was. And I remember sitting there and had the moment and I was like, I don't need all these rules and bullshit to be a good person and help people.
Yeah.
I'm going to be a good person without the structure.
And did you immediately see journalism as a way of doing that?
No. So I got back and I was working at the bank and I saw myself, you know, in Africa, you know, helping build villages for poor people, which I now have a very different view on.
You were imagining yourself right at the coalface.
I was imagining myself, yeah, helping to lift people out of poverty and but, you know, in that very egotistical, naive, Western hero kind of way.
Right.
So I've since become aware of some other perspectives on development and how things can work best in other communities. But that's what I was imagining. I was in there in the suit and tie at Deutsche Bank wanting to be in Africa, like helping people out. And so, but I thought I needed some credibility and some money. So I stuck it out for 2 years at Deutsche Bank. I went to London for training, learned a whole bunch of stuff about stock market valuation, and then came back for another year in Sydney.
Party in London?
Little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I met it back up with the Spanish guys actually. Went down nice. To the, they were living in, is it Camberwell, just south of Brixton? And
It's like, it's not as a famous a raving time as like the late 90s and stuff, but there's some great electronic music and parties going on.
This was 2002.
Yeah.
And so we went, they took me, this girl, Belen Altozano, she took me to this rave. You went down the side of the train tracks where there's a big brick bridge overarching the road, and then there are these other arches. And so they park a van across, you pay £5 to get past the van into the party. In the first railway arch is like hardcore drum and bass. And then you got sort of more like rugga reggae kind of sound. And then techno in the third one.
Awesome.
She asked me if I wanted an ecstasy tablet, and I said no.
as you would. So yes, after 2 years, you come home and you got out of the bank.
Yeah, and my brother was my little crazy brother. He was a pretty wild kid. He was going to Africa for 3 months, and he'd already been to Morocco once and already got himself into a boxing match at 3 a.m. in the square at Marrakesh. And I'm like, I'm not going to hear about your trip in Africa over email. I'm coming. So I quit my job, and I'd had this Dutch girlfriend that I actually met on that Barcelona trip as well. And so I quit my job, sold my car, went to Africa for 3 months, traveled with my brother. We hitchhiked and camped all the way through from South Africa up to Nairobi.
Wow. So that's quite a road trip in Africa.
Yeah. It was a good vibe.
What was your chosen music blaring on the radio as you were driving around? Did you have the CD wallet with a couple of?
Oh, what's that? What's that song? Kevin Little turned me on. Like, okay. That was a perfect representation of what was going off in Africa at that time. And it was unbelievable. So you'd get like 5 or 6 year old boys and girls doing the most hectic booty shaking to that music. They were going off.
Yeah.
And it was so interesting to see the way that musical traditions in America and Africa were still interacting.
Yeah.
There was a real sense that like it was bouncing across that ocean, you know, that you had these descendants of Africans living in America for many generations, but they still shared so much with these people, so much that when that music came back across, there was a huge reaction in Africa. And I got the feeling that some of that vibe was coming back to these artists in America and inspiring their next works.
Yeah, I think that exchange of ideas and inspiration from Africa to America. I was reading a lot about Muhammad Ali recently, and you know, his trips to Africa and when he fought there and how he was received by people. It's really interesting. How did you get to Triple J?
So I got back from a year in Amsterdam of just trying a bunch of different stuff out, and then I thought I wanted to be a documentary maker, so I cut up some of the footage from the Africa trip and I applied for a job at SBS, cut a little short film. And they really liked it, nearly got a job there, but it didn't quite, and then started doing some like kind of interning with...
Were you influenced at all by A Race Around the World?
Like that was happening at the time, and Sony had made that mini DV camera. So sort of video journalism or VJs were becoming a thing, and
right.
Filmmaking was becoming accessible to everyone all of a sudden. And that was a massive game changer for documentary making. And that's where I thought I wanted to head, because I wanted to be out on the road and traveling and meeting people and engaging. And
had you saved up a bit of money in the banking job to help you through these things?
Or I had a little bit left, but I lived on it through my year at Amsterdam, where I was like an underemployed part-time model. So
okay. What kind of modeling did you do?
All kinds of stuff. I did like catwalk for G-Star, catalogs, hair, TV guides.
Yeah, now I just want to get on the Google and find some of the images.
There's none.
There's none?
There wasn't much going up at that time. That's so sexy. There is a book hidden somewhere in this house.
Okay.
I don't know if we're quite there yet.
So, yeah, you wanted to be in documentaries and
yeah. Started to get some part-time work helping out independent doco makers. And then a friend of my dad's was working at the ABC, so I got some part-time work over Christmas as a sort of an assistant in the newsroom. And then I hung around and just got shifts throughout the next year, two or three a week. Did some post-grad study at UTS and then...
What did you do at UTS?
Journalism.
Yeah, right. So I studied journalism at UTS in the late 90s. Then I made up all my articles and discovered it wasn't the profession for me. But I went and did like a post-grad sound post-production there.
All right, yeah. Well, I was doing post-grad like radio and feature writing and stuff like that, yeah. So
great studios.
And then, I'd pieced together a bit of experience in the ABC. I'd done a bit of talkback producing as well, so I got to know a bit of live radio. I produced a feature for Radio National out of one of my uni projects. Got a feature up in the Herald. So I was starting to piece together a bit of like respectable stuff.
And that's the way it works with the ABC, isn't it? You've got to do the hours, it seems to me. You got to
hang around. You get to know people.
Yeah.
Piece together some other experience as well. Get some respect from outside, I think helps. And then I went for my first full-time gig there for Triple J. Thought I was an outside chance and they took an outside chance on me.
Were you, did you develop a passion for Triple J after not having listened to much when you were a kid? Were you into it in those in between?
I really hit my purple patch with Triple J around the age of 17, 18, 19. I really dug it when I was in the country and I really dug being connected to the city and what was going on, which has totally fueled my passion for Triple J and the service that it brings to regional Australia. Big reason I really love the station.
Mm.
Musically, I was often tending towards 2WS.
Right. Right. So still more classic into the older hits. Stuff.
But I was bouncing between like 2WS, Mix FM, which was more classics at the time, and Triple J.
Okay. And in all this time, how was your music performing going?
Yeah. So in before I left the church, we played some big gigs and we recorded an album. We had a gospel blues band.
What was the name of the gospel blues band?
Clarity. That leads to the story.
What was the Clarity sound? Like gospel blues.
The lead guy was a really good musician. He was at jazz school in Canberra.
Right.
And he played clarinet. He was a good singer. It was quite bluesy. Yeah. When I got back from Amsterdam, and I played a lot in Amsterdam as well, actually, I was going to all these blues sessions, like jam open mic sessions. Every Tuesday, Wednesday night, I was cruising around Amsterdam with my guitar on my back, hitting these jam sessions.
With an acoustic or?
No, I had my Fender Strat.
Okay.
So I was cruising around town, just jamming the blues, and I'd get up and front the blues band sometimes or just play rhythm guitar.
Because you're still singing a bit.
Yeah, I loved it. And when I got back, this friend of mine who'd been the front man of Clarity had really gotten into his guitar. He already played piano quite well. He was like fully trained
clarinet. Before we move on, like are there any blues songs that you remember playing in Amsterdam? Like do you remember any, is there any blues that you had a passion for at that time?
I remember playing a lot of Bill Withers' Ain't No Sunshine at that time, that kind of stuff, like the soul-y end of blues.
Beautiful.
Beautiful tune. Jamming to those kind of minor chord progressions. I like that. Playing a lot of minor sevenths. And when I got back, this friend Tim, he was already great at clarinet. He picked up saxophone in that time. His piano chops were up and he'd spent a year working on his guitar playing. I got back and he was really good. And him and I both left the church by then, but we were still mates. And we reformed Clarity with me as the bass player, him as the guitarist.
Right on.
And we got a drummer and we started playing again. So we played, our first gig back was the Roxburgh Hotel in Glebe. And then
so this is instrumental blues? Like
No, we changed it. It had gone totally funk, Prince inspired funk.
Right. You look so
weak. Well, we were like just sounding like early Prince. Three piece, guitar, bass, drums. And so we became mates with the Professor Groove guys and we became their support act. So we started playing at the Basement, which was beyond our wildest fucking dreams.
So the Basement is a Sydney institution. It's the jazz, the blues venue. Still going.
And it's an amazing venue.
I was a bartender there in 99.
Wow.
I did like there for a year because I just loved it so much. I ended up just working there.
That would be a cool place to be behind the bar.
It was wild. Absolutely wild. The after parties would go on until the sun came up.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Remember Dennis Chambers, the drummer? His drink was 4 shots of Bacardi and a little bit of Coke in the top. Okay. And you would take it out to Dennis and then he would come and sit at the bar. Anyway. The Roxbury, you're playing a bit of funk.
Yeah, so we're getting gigs at the Basement, which was mind-blowing for us. We supported a band at the Oxford Art Factory when it had just opened. We started going down to Melbourne and playing some gigs down there.
It's really interesting to me because you have the dual journalist bass playing Rockstar Life at the moment, but you've been doing that for a long time.
Well, this
then,
is a funny
career
thing.
And music.
People just sort of saw me come out of nowhere with the Client Liaison thing because we were playing really big shows. The first show I played with Client Liaison was at the Forum.
Yeah, which is a 2,000 capacity Melbourne venue, yeah.
Yeah, we were supporting Fly Facilities. And so that was a big, massive step up. But I love gigging. Like I've been playing gigs for a long time from the church days. And then mid-2000s, like we got Clarity up again. And then I was playing in 2 or 3 other bands at the same time. So I was playing a gig a week. I was in Brendan McLean's band. He was a Triple J host and he's gone on to do really good things.
I'm not worthy, but I'm just
I was loving my bass playing. Like I was mad for it and it was a bit of blues, a bit of country, funk. And then in Clarity, we ended up throwing out the guitars and I started playing all the songs on Moog bass. We went for a more like presets, Daft Punk kind of sound, but fully live, no track.
Still under the name Clarity.
Yeah.
Didn't consider changing the name. There's no clarinet anymore, Tom.
Everyone thought the name was hopeless. Claire Collins, who's a good friend of mine and is a big music manager, she loved me and hated my band. Was really open about it. But she still loved coming to the shows.
That's funny.
And we had this film clip for a song that we wrote called Kate Moss, She's Boss. And a few friends of mine tell me that whenever they're feeling sad, they put that on just to laugh. Talking about
Kate Moss. So well, I guess I want to ask you that because it seems it's a part of your life that's really interesting to me. So many people think you have to choose one. You either have to, if you're committed to the career that you've achieved in journalism, then there's no room for a career in music to achieve the things that you achieve, but you show that you're able to do both.
Well, it was just a hobby, you know, it wasn't another career.
But you're still like traveling to do gigs and...
Yeah. I still was putting, some people are in a sporting team and they train 2 nights a week and travel on Saturday to play sport. I was putting that into music, you know, I'd be rehearsing 1 or 2 nights a week with a band, maybe doing a bit of my own rehearsals and then maybe playing a gig every week or two. So that was kind of when it was hobby level. And then when I joined the Client Liaison live show.
How did that happen?
That was pretty interesting. We became friends with Harvey and Monty. We met them at a music festival.
This is you and the other guy in Clarity.
No. He wasn't involved. He was out of my life by then.
Sorry, you just said we.
We was my crew of friends in Sydney. So right. we were all like having a big old rave down at Secret Garden Festival. And Client Liaison was in super early stages and they had a set. And Tyson, my good friend and flatmate, Tyson Coe from Rage, he'd met them doing Rage, I think. And they started kicking around the festival with us.
What year would this be?
2014. Yeah, so they'd released the EP and they were starting to tour a bit, but it was still very basic. Harvey on a Triton keyboard and they were running a pretty basic live show, but they were really capturing a lot of attention. People were loving them and they were awesome. And so they started partying with us and Harvey fell in love with one of our friends and started a relationship with this Sydney girl. And so whenever he'd come to Sydney, they'd come and hang with us and Monty and Harvey had come for dinner with us and we got to know them and they loved Clarity. Like Monty had a lot in common with my old friend, Tim, the lead singer, and they were like, oh, that's so great. And then-
In terms of a lot in common in terms of musically? Or?
Very 80s.
Yeah.
Very 80s, very intense, big performer.
And it takes a certain disregard of what other people think.
It's cheesy.
Yeah.
And Harvey and Monty have nailed it. We hadn't.
Right.
But, you know, they took an interest in my music. And then one night I played a gig with Professor Groove and the Booty Affair. at Frieda's in Chippendale. And Harvey was there hanging out with his Sydney girlfriend. And, you know, he'd been so locked into programming on Cubase and, you know, doing a live set with a lot of backing track. He came up to me after the set and was like, "That's so amazing." We had Terrapi Richmond on drums. We had like fully jazz trained keyboardists and great singers, and Josh Begley on guitar, originally from Swoop, is like one of the best kind of funk rhythm guitarists getting around. So,
do they play originals? Did you guys play originals?
There's some originals.
Yeah, or was it covers as well? And
it's mostly like soul and house classic covers.
And then just going off on jams for like 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Harvey came up and he's just like, "Oh, so great to see live instruments, like just really going for it and improvising, but still being really tight because you've got Terrapi on drums."
Mm.
And hopefully my bass playing was reasonably tight as well.
But well, he's known as the human metronome, Terrapi.
Yeah, he's amazing. So Harvey'd seen that I could play and was sort of impressed with what I could do on the bass in that band. And then I went to, and this is where the juxtaposition between journalism and music really comes to a head. I got sent to the Middle East to report on the Syrian civil war. I went to Jordan and did some stories from the refugee camps.
Tom Tilley, presenter of ABC Hack on Triple J, is there, and here he is.
This is refugees being called in for interviews.
The head of the UNHCR here in Jordan is Australian Andrew Harper. He's showing me around the Amman Processing Centre.
So this is an area where...
And when I got back, Harvey's girlfriend said, "Hey, TT, Harvey's going to call you about playing with them on a Like a Version. They're doing at Triple J." So he rings me and he goes, "Hey, we're doing a Like a Version. We want to break out of the two-man thing and make it more organic and more of a live band feel. So we've got my brother on guitar and we wanted you to play bass. Can you rehearse for the next 2 days? I was like, "Yeah, yeah, I can."
Awesome.
And so I got in the room with them and a really nice punchy little bass amp. And they put on the track for Queen, which is one of my favorite Client Liaison songs, probably because of this moment. But the verse bass riff, it's just bump, 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 bump. And I hit those notes and it locked in. And we just had one of those moments where everyone went, "Oh, that feels good."
Sick.
And then I think before we'd even done the Like a Version, they were like,
"Do you remember what you did for Like a Version?"
Yeah, we did "Why Don't You Come Join My Party" by Christine Arnoux. And then Harvey remixed it into Song Formerly Known As by Regurgitator. So it was a bit of a mashup.
Wow.
And then they're like, "Oh, we'd love to feature you on these two songs for our live show. We're in the middle of a flight facility support tour. Do you want to play the Sydney gigs?" I'm like, "Where are they?" They're like, "The Enmore." I was like, "Sure."
So was that? So the Enmore was at 2,000 capacity. It's kind of one of the famous Sydney venues. Had you ever done gigs on that scale before?
Nowhere near it. Except at church. I played to a few thousand people at church.
Right.
But never in my adult life. And then they actually rang me before that gig. Like, that was a week's time away. And they rang me and said, "You know what, come and do the Melbourne show with us on Friday. We're going to fly down and put you up in Melbourne. We're going to play the Forum." So I go to Melbourne, I play the Forum, first ever show with Client Liaison.
How did you feel about it? Were you nervous? Was it exciting? Did you nail it?
I was nervous. It was exciting. Played okay.
Sweet. All of the above.
It was tough to get the stage sound right there. And I hadn't played on those kind of stages. And at the time, the bass used to really rattle through the stage and almost come at you in delay. And
it takes a while to realize that in those big gigs, it actually just never sounds great.
Yeah.
It's always going to be.
You've got to accept compromise. Yeah.
And you just got to get through the gig.
Yeah. I've been used to these like boxy little rehearsal rooms where it sounded tight, you know.
What's the biggest gig you've done now with Client Liaison?
Splendor this year, main stage. Apparently it was 25,000.
Far out.
Yeah. But that night in Melbourne was interesting. So we play the Melbourne show and it goes okay. And we're at the flight facility's after party. And Adam, the band manager, says to me, "What are you doing tomorrow?" I'm like, "I don't know." He's like, "You want to come to Brisbane?" Suddenly I was on tour. And then I was in the band from then onwards, the live show.
And this is while you're also doing 5 days a week of Hack.
Yeah. And so this is where it got kind of interesting. And so I started spending a lot of weekends flying to Melbourne to rehearse all weekends to put together a proper live show before we did our first tour about 3 or 4 months later. And I was like, okay, so I'm working all week. And I thought once I started hosting Hack that would be so flat out I could never fit anything else into my life. And that was a massive goal for me to host that program. And I was super stoked with it. And it meant a lot to me. And I wasn't wanting to do anything that would compromise my performance at work. But now I was spending my weekends rehearsing, which is also hard work. Like I like rehearsing, and I like getting things right. And
the live being client liaison, they are particular and have an amazing show. And you can tell that they have that because the attention to detail in their music and in everything.
Mm. But bringing live instruments into that was a very new thing, and that wasn't easy necessarily to find the right parts.
Do you have a favourite moment in client liaison set which you play? Do you love a particular song?
I really like Queen. Maybe it's because the song I was first playing when I was in the band, but it's a very rousing, uplifting song. You know, the words are about being more than you are and dreaming big.
Right.
Seeing yourself as a queen. So that is probably my favourite song. And we've got like a really funky kind of coda that we put into it as well, which I always enjoy doing, which has like a little bit of fast bass.
It's a flex a little bit.
16th notes in there, yeah, so it's good.
You're a DJ now too. When did you start DJing?
I used to do it just for fun, like years and years ago, just at friends' parties and stuff like that.
Just other people had records and you would kind of get into it, or?
Just throw down some CDs or whatever. My friend was throwing this club night in the Cross called Shameless, which was like all 80s tunes. And that was the first time I got asked to DJ because she just knew I loved 80s tunes.
What year would that be?
That was like 06, 07.
Right.
Or 08.
A long time ago.
But I didn't really know how to DJ, and she really rode me in the booth, my friend. She was like really schooling me. Her name's Ariane, and she's a good DJ around Sydney. So then I gave it away for a while, and then I started DJing at client liaison after parties. Okay. That's when it kicked off again. And then a few people heard, I'd done that once or twice, and then two or three separate booking agents got in touch and said, if you're DJing again and people know who you are on Triple J, we can farm you out and you can start doing this more often and make a little bit of pocket money. So yeah, I started doing it.
Do you like it?
Yeah, I love it. I love it.
What kind of music do you like playing? Do you still get into the old 70s, 80s funk, or do you?
A little bit. I sort of generally go through a similar narrative each time, but with different songs. I'll start with something that completely changes the mood of the room, because often I'm coming off after these local heroes who are playing really heavy stuff, and I'll just throw on like Arnold or something like that. It's just like, all right, we're going to mix it up now. I don't mind if I clear the floor a little bit. The stayers, you know, the people that are into my stuff will come back.
No, I can definitely feel that. You got to let everyone know, A, that you've started, and that it's not going to...
Well, it's a set, isn't it? It's a journey. So yeah. You want to mark the start of that journey. You don't want a soft start.
Absolutely.
Maybe you do want a soft start, but I didn't. And so...
Me either, Tom.
So I would start off like there, and then I would play some disco just to build the mood. But like in a lot of these clubs I'm playing where it's pretty young crowd, like disco's not quite heavy enough for them. It's more of like it's tanking you somewhere. So I'll work up to that, and then I'll move that into like new disco. And somewhere in the mix there will be my favorite song ever produced, which is Todd Turier's Inspector Norse.
Wow.
That groove is just so full of... You feel super high when you hear that
full of joy,
full of that joy, full of elevation. Like you're just floating on top of that song. It's such a good feeling. It's a really tight little groove, but the little bits of melody flying around the boo, 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 like it's just so much fun. And I had a weird experience with it. I was traveling in Buenos Aires about 5 years ago, and it was on in every club. And everywhere I went, it was catching my ear. And it was hitting me some deeper than it should have. And I was like, I think I must have heard that in Sydney before. And it's like, it's plugging some memories, and it all sort of linked up. And I loved it ever since then. Anyway, once I've hit some newer stuff like that, newish, it's pretty old now, but then I'll go deeper into more contemporary kind of house sounds. So like often it's like Disclosure and that kind of stuff. And maybe even like a Motez or a Young Franco kind of sound. And then I'll usually want to make it more silly after that, and that's when I'll go from contemporary house to 90s pop house, like Right on Time and Finally and all that kind of stuff, like Tank It There, and it almost gets a bit, some of that almost blends into R&B, and then then I'll just go out with some like just really fruity pop, like Madonna or something like that.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Do you get on the mic when you DJ?
I get on the mic a lot. I think it's great when you're out to feel connected to the performer and like to
very underrated skill.
Yeah.
Do you ever want to run away and join the music circus? Because I've seen you at festivals and stuff, both of us with a cocktail in hand, surrounded by lovely, fun, crazy people who are all deep in that circus. They're all touring and doing stuff.
Yeah, I could spend a few years touring flat out. No problem. I would love to. I will always like do journalism, always want to make media, and I want to make documentaries and write books and continue in radio. But I've always wanted to tour. And I never thought this client liaison thing would happen in my life, but I did have visions of it as a kid, and I feel so lucky that it's happened, and I love the experience, and I put lots of energy into it, and I work really hard on my parts in the set, all the choreography and stuff, and I love the boys. Like, we have an amazing relationship. Like, we work hard together and we can be really frank with each other.
You're in the band.
We're in the band. We work hard on it, and everyone in that band has the same commitment to the theatre of it. And that's what our roadies have noticed as well, where they're like, you guys are freaks, but you're actually really, really serious about your output and what the show is and how it all joins up, and that it's seamless, and that we don't break the fourth wall unless it's the right moment to break the fourth wall. And there's a sense of humor and silliness to it, but we want each moment, we want that linear experience that an audience member has throughout the course of the set to be epic.
Yes.
And I love working on that with the boys, and it goes back to being in musical theatre and all that kind of stuff. And we make our own choreography, you know, so it's me and those three boys from Melbourne standing in a rehearsal room going, well, okay, well, we'll do left foot here, then we'll clap, and you know, we work it out step by step, and it's grueling.
I remember seeing you when we were doing Falls Festival together. We were in the lounge, and the laptop came out from Harvey, I think, and put it down, and they had the video. You had the video from last night's set, and the discussion began about dance moves and lighting
and who'd fucked up.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
So hopefully you can continue the double life long into the future, Tom. Is that the plan?
Yeah, well, we've done a lot of the Aussie touring on this album cycle, and so once my fucking leg gets fixed, I will be on stage again, and we're hoping to do a lot of Euro touring next year. So,
right, how would that work with your Triple J stuff? You just work it out.
I've been warning my boss that this is coming for a while, and we've got an understanding, and I've got long service leave. If we're able to negotiate it and the timing all works, and it's a bit give and take, I'll be taking a little bit of time off in maybe July, August to hopefully tour Europe with the boys.
What an amazing thing for you to do, to return to Europe.
Yeah,
the band.
Man.
Tom, thanks for your time. I got one more question, and you got to give me your top five favourite songs of all time. You've already said Inspector North for number one, so yeah, and I'll give you my top five, and my top five is going to be different every time. Number five is I Want You Back by the Jackson 5. Number four is Paranoid Android by Radiohead. Number three is To Build a Home by Cinematic Orchestra, which I was a song that me and wife danced to at our wedding. Number two is Tell Me by What's So Not. And
oh, wow.
By Rob Ryan. Bangers. You know, we've always got the journey across the decades.
Yeah, totally.
And then for number one this time, I will go for Day in the Life by the Beatles.
Oh, nice.
I read the news today, oh boy.
Yeah, I would definitely have in there All Along the Watchtower, the Jimi Hendrix version, not the Bob Dylan version. Just the most epic piece of music, so powerful. The words are so full of imagery and poetry.
And was that one that you were into when you were learning guitar?
Yeah, loved it. And there's a 3 to 4 seconds of that guitar solo in the middle of the track that is my favourite bit of music. A little bit where he runs back down the fretboard, it's like tingles, you know? Let's Dance, David Bowie.
Oh, okay.
Love it.
Nile Rodgers produced.
Yeah.
Fun song to DJ with, isn't it? Because the opening is so strong, it just kind of, just drop it, isn't it?
It's huge. It's huge. I should drop it more often. Bizarre Love Triangle, New Order.
Nice.
For me, New Wave is the perfect juncture between pop and disco with a touch of sadness, which I love. Really good. Inspector Norse, Todd Turier, is in my top five. Does that leave me one more?
It does. One more.
Oh, yeah, it could be a Beatles tune as well, or it could be something even more.
Well, that's the tricky thing about the top five. Do you go for, like, I obviously went for the credible number one by going back for Day in the Life and the Beatles. Yeah. You shouldn't feel swayed by that.
Yeah, no, it just reminded me, I loved the Beatles so much. I was such a huge Beatles fan. Does it come from that era, or is it... I feel like I need to give more of a nod to funk as well. That's where, like, Chic or James Brown maybe need to come into the mix, or even just a sleazy classic like Brick House by the Commodores.
Ooh,
let's go with that.
I like it.
Yeah, Brick House.
Cool, that's it. Thanks, Tom.
Thanks, cool, bro. Man. Yeah, my pleasure, dude. I love talking about music.
Yeah. That's it. That was episode 3 of Hot Dub Time Machine Radio. Thank you so much for listening. If you want to see Tom Tilley and me, DJ, come to Hot Dub Wine Machine. There's another 5 of them all around the country. You can get tickets at wine-machine.com. And if you want to send me a message about anything at all, you can find me on all social medias as Hot Dub Time Machine. See you next week. What's your favourite song?
Paper Airplane.